McGovern and his friend were walking in the direction of the nurse's station, probably bound for the water fountain. Lois was in hot pursuit, trotting up the corridor, bosom heaving. Her aura flashed with twizzling pinkish sparks that looked like neon-flavored asterisks. Ralph bolted after her. He didn't know what would happen if she caught McGovern's attention and didn't really want to find out. He thought he was probably going to, however.
Lois, Lois, don't do that. She ignored him.
Bill, stop. You have to listen to me. Something's wrong with you.
McGovern paid no attention to her. He was talking about Bob Paul Hurst's manuscript later that summer.
Best damn book on the Civil War I ever read, he told the man inside the plum-colored aura. But when I suggested that he publish, he told me that was out of the question. Can you believe it? A possible Pulitzer Prize winner, but...
Lois, come back. Don't go near him.
Bill, Bill, Bill...
Lois reached McGovern just before Ralph was able to reach her. She put out her hand to grab his shoulder. Ralph saw her fingers plunge into the murk which surrounded him, and then slide into him. Her aura changed at once, from a gray-blue shot with those pinkish sparks, to a red as bright as the side of a fire engine. Jagged flocks of black shot through it like clouds of tiny swarming insects. Lois screamed and pulled her hand back. The expression on her face was a mixture of terror and loathing. She held her hand up in front of her eyes and screamed again, although Ralph could see nothing on it. Narrow black stripes were now whirring giddily around the outer edges of her aura. To Ralph, they looked like planetary orbits marked on a map of the solar system. She turned to flee. Ralph grabbed her by the upper arms, and she beat at him blindly. McGovern and his friend, meanwhile, continued their placid amble up the hall to the drinking fountain, completely unaware of the shrieking, struggling woman not 10 feet behind them. When I asked Bob why he wouldn't publish the book, McGovern was continuing, he said that I, of all people, should understand his reasons. I told him... Lois drowned him out, shrieking like a fire bell.
Quit it, Lois. Quit it right now. Whatever happened to you is over now. It's over, and you're all right.
But Lois continued to struggle, dinning those inarticulate screams into his head, trying to tell him how awful it had been, how he'd been rotting, that there were things inside him, eating him alive. And that was bad enough, but it wasn't the worst. Those things were aware, she said, and they were bad, and they had known she was there.
Lois, you're with me. You're with me, and it's all right.
One of her flying fists clipped the side of his jaw, and Ralph saw stars. He understood that they had passed to a plane of reality where physical contact with others was impossible. Hadn't he seen Lois's hand pass directly into McGovern, like the hand of a ghost? But they were obviously still real enough to each other. He had the bruised jaw to prove it. He slipped his arms around her and hugged her against him, imprisoning her fists between her breasts and his chest. Her cries, continued to rant and blast in his head, however. He locked his hands together between her shoulder blades and squeezed. He felt the power leap out of him again, as it had that morning, only this time it felt entirely different. Blue light spilled through Lois's turbulent red-black aura, soothing it. Her struggles slowed and then ceased. He felt her draw a shuddering breath. Above and around her, the blue glow was expanding and fading. The black bands disappeared from her aura, one after the other, from the bottom up, and then that alarming shade of infected red also began to fade. She put her head against his arm.
I'm sorry, Ralph. I went nuclear again, didn't I?
I suppose so, but never mind. You're okay now. That's the important thing.
If you knew how horrible that was, touching him that way.
You put it across very well, Lois. She glanced down the corridor, where McGovern's friend was now getting a drink. McGovern lounged against the wall next to him, talking about how the exalted and revered Bob Paul Hurst had always done the Sunday New York Times crossword puzzle in ink.
He used to tell me that wasn't pride, but optimism, McGovern said.
And the death bag swirled sluggishly around him as he spoke, flowing in and out of his mouth and between the fingers of his gesturing, eloquent hand.
"We can't help him, can we, Ralph? There's not a thing in the world we can do."
Ralph gave her a brief, strong hug. Her aura, he saw, had entirely returned to normal. McGovern and his friend were walking back down the corridor toward them. Acting on impulse, Ralph disengaged himself from Lois and stepped directly in front of Mr. Plum, who was listening to McGovern hold forth on the tragedy of old age and nodding in the right places.
"Ralph, don't do that."
"It's okay, don't worry." But all at once, he wasn't so sure it was okay. He might have stepped back given another second. Before he could, however, Mr. Plum glanced unseeingly into his face and walked right through him. The sensation that swept through Ralph's body at his passage was perfectly familiar. It was the pins and needles feeling one gets when a sleeping limb starts to wake up. For one moment, his aura and Mr. Plum's mingled, and Ralph knew everything about the man that there was to know, including the dreams he'd had in his mother's womb. Mr. Plum stopped short.
"Something wrong?" McGovern asked.
"I guess not, but did you hear a bang someplace? Like a firecracker or a car backfire?"
"Can't say I did, but my hearing isn't what it used to be," McGovern chuckled.
"If something did blow up, I certainly hope it wasn't in one of the radiation labs."
"I don't hear anything now, probably just my imagination."
They turned into Bob Paulhurst's room. Ralph thought, "Mrs. Perrine said it sounded like a gunshot. Lois's friend thought there was a bug on her, maybe biting her. Just a difference in touch, maybe, the way different piano players have different touches. Either way, they feel it when we mess with them. They may not know what it is, but they sure do feel it."
Lois took his hand and led him to the door of room 313. They stood in the hall, looking in as McGovern seated himself in a plastic contour chair at the foot of the bed. There were at least 8 people crammed into the room, and Ralph couldn't see Bob Paulhurst clearly, but he could see one thing. Although he was deep within his own death bag, Paulhurst's balloon string was still intact. It was as filthy as a rusty exhaust pipe, peeling in some places and cracked in others, but it was still intact. He turned to Lois. "These people may have longer to wait than they think." Lois nodded, then pointed down at the greeny gold footprints, the white man tracks. They bypassed 313, Ralph saw, but turned in at the next doorway. 315, Jimmy V's room. He and Lois walked up together and stood looking in. Jimmy V had 3 visitors, and the one sitting beside the bed thought he was all alone. That one was Faye Chapin, idly looking through the double stack of get-well cards on Jimmy's bedside table. The other two were the little bald doctors Ralph had seen for the first time on May Locker's stoop. They stood at the foot of Jimmy V's bed, solemn in their clean white tunics, and now that he stood close to them, Ralph could see that there were worlds of character in those unlined, almost identical faces. It just wasn't the sort of thing one could see through a pair of binoculars. Or maybe not until you slid up the ladder of perception a little way. Most of it was in the eyes, which were dark, pupilless, and flecked with deep golden glints. Those eyes shone with intelligence and lively awareness. Their auras gleamed and flashed around them like the robes of emperors, or perhaps of centurions on a visit of state. They looked over at Ralph and Lois, who stood holding hands in the doorway, like children who have lost their way in a fairy tale wood, and smiled at them.
"Hello, woman."
That was Doc Number One. He was holding the scissors in his right hand. The blades were very long, and the points looked very sharp. Doc Number Two took a step toward them and made a funny little half bow.
"Hello, man. We've been waiting for you."
Ralph felt Lois's hand tighten on his own, then loosen as she decided they were in no immediate danger. She took a small step forward, looking from Doc Number One to Doc Number Two, and then back to Number One again.
"Who are you?"
Doc Number One crossed his arms over his small chest. The long blades of his scissors lay the entire length of his white-clad left forearm.
"We don't have names, not the way short-timers do.
But you may call us after the fates in the story this man has already told you. That these names originally belonged to women means little to us, since we are creatures with no sexual dimension. I will be Clotho, although I spin no thread, and my colleague and old friend will be Lachesis, although he shakes no rods and has never thrown the coins. Come in, both of you, please. They came in and stood warily between the visitor's chair and the bed. Ralph didn't think the docks meant them any harm, for now at least, but he still didn't want to get too close. Their auras, so bright and fabulous compared to those of ordinary people, intimidated him, and he could see from Lois's wide eyes and half-open mouth that she felt the same. She sensed him looking at her, turned toward him, and tried to smile. My Lois, Ralph thought. He put an arm around her shoulders and hugged her briefly. Lachesis, we've given you our names, names you may use at any rate. Won't you give us yours? Lois, you mean you don't already know? Pardon me, but I find that hard to believe. Lachesis, we could know, but choose not to. We like to observe the rules of common short-time politeness wherever we can. We find them lovely, for they are passed on by your kind from large hand to small, and create the illusion of long lives. I don't understand. Ralph didn't either, and wasn't sure he wanted to. He found something faintly patronizing in the tone of the one who called himself Lachesis, something that reminded him of McGovern when he was in a mood to lecture or pontificate. Lachesis, it doesn't matter. We felt sure you would come. We know that you are watching us on Monday morning, man, at the home of... At this point, there was a queer overlapping in Lachesis' speech. He seemed to say two things at exactly the same time, the terms rolling together like a snake with its own tail in its mouth. May Locker, the finished woman. Lois took a hesitant step forward. My name is Lois Chass. My friend is Ralph Roberts. And now that we've all been properly introduced, maybe you two fellows will tell us what's going on around here. Lachesis. There is another to be named. Clotho. Ralph Roberts has already named him. Lois looked at Ralph, who was nodding his head. They're talking about Dock Number 3, right, guys? Clotho and Lachesis nodded. They were wearing identical approving smiles. Ralph supposed he should have been flattered, but he wasn't. Instead, he was afraid and very angry. They had been neatly manipulated every step down the line. This was no chance meeting. It had been a setup from the word go. Clotho and Lachesis, just a couple of little bald doctors with time on their hands, standing around in Jimmy V's room waiting for the short timers to arrive. Ho-hum. Ralph glanced over at Faye and saw he had taken a book called 50 Classic Chess Problems out of his back pocket. He was reading and picking his nose in ruminative fashion as he did so. After a few preliminary explorations, Faye dove deep and hooked a big one. He examined it, then parked it on the underside of the bedside table. Ralph looked away, embarrassed, and a saying of his grandmother's popped into his mind. Peek not through a keyhole, lest ye be vexed. He had lived to be 70 without fully understanding that. At last he thought he did. Meanwhile, another question had occurred to him. Why doesn't Faye see us? Why didn't Bill and his friend see us, for that matter? And how could that man walk right through me? Or did I just imagine that? Clotho smiled. You didn't imagine it. Try to think of life as a kind of building, Ralph. What you would call a skyscraper. Except that wasn't quite what Clotho was thinking of, Ralph discovered. For one flickering moment he seemed to catch an image from the mind of the other. One he found both exciting and disturbing. An enormous tower constructed of dark and sooty stone, standing in a field of red roses. Slit windows twisted up its sides in a brooding spiral. Then it was gone. You and Lois and all the other short-time creatures live on the first two floors of this structure. Of course there are elevators. No, Ralph thought. Not in the tower I saw in your mind, my little friend. In that building, if such a building actually exists, there are no elevators, only a narrow staircase festooned with cobwebs and doorways leading to God knows what. Lachesis was looking at him with a strange, almost suspicious curiosity, and Ralph decided he didn't much care for that look. He turned back to Clotho and motioned for him to go on. Clotho, as I was saying, there are elevators, but short-timers are not allowed to use them under ordinary circumstances. You are not ready? Prepared? The last explanation was clearly the best, but it danced away from Ralph just before he could grasp it. He looked at Lois, who shook her head, and then back at Clotho and Lachesis again. He was beginning to feel angrier than ever. All the long, endless nights sitting in the wing chair and waiting for dawn. All the days he'd spent feeling like a ghost inside his own skin. The inability to remember a sentence unless he read it 3 times. The phone numbers, once carried in his head, which he now had to look up. A memory came then, one which simultaneously summed up and justified the anger he felt as he looked at these bald creatures with their darkly golden eyes and almost blinding auras. He saw himself peering into the cupboard over his kitchen counter, looking for the powdered soup his tired, overstrained mind insisted must be in there someplace. He saw himself poking, pausing, then poking some more. He saw the expression on his face, a look of distant perplexity that could easily have been mistaken for mild mental retardation, but which was really simple exhaustion. Then he saw himself drop his hands and simply stand there, as if he expected the packet to jump out on its own. Not until now, at this moment, and at this memory, did he realize how totally horrible the last few months had been. Looking back at them was like looking into a wasteland painted in desolate maroons and grays. "So you took us onto the elevator. Or maybe that wasn't good enough for the likes of us, and you just trotted us up the fire stairs. Got us acclimated a little at a time, so we wouldn't strip our gears completely, I imagine. And it was easy. All you had to do was rob us of our sleep until we were half crazy. Lois's son and daughter-in-law want to put her in a theme park for geriatrics. Did you know that? And my friend Bill McGovern thinks I'm ready for Juniper Hill. Meanwhile, you little angels..." Clotho offered just a trace of his former wide smile. "We're no angels, Ralph." "Ralph, please, don't shout at them." Yes, he had been shouting, and at least some of it seemed to have gotten through to Fay. He had closed his chess book, stopped picking his nose, and was now sitting bolt upright in his chair, looking uneasily about the room. Ralph looked from Clotho, who took a step backward, losing what was left of his smile, to Lachesis. "Your friend says you're not angels. So where are they? Playing poker 6 or 8 floors farther up? And I suppose God's in the penthouse, and the devil's stoking coal in the boiler room." No reply. Clotho and Lachesis glanced doubtfully at each other. Lois plucked at Ralph's sleeve, but he ignored her. "So what are we supposed to do, guys? Track down your little bald version of Hannibal Lecter and take his scalpel away? Well, fuck you." Ralph would have turned on his heel and walked out then. He had seen a lot of movies, and he knew a good exit line when he heard one. But Lois burst into shocked, frightened tears, and that held him where he was. The look of bewildered reproach in her eyes made him regret his outburst, at least a little. He slipped his arm back around Lois's shoulders and looked at the two bald men defiantly. They exchanged another glance, and something, some communication just above his and Lois's ability to hear or understand, passed between them. When Lachesis turned to them again, he was smiling, but his eyes were grave. "I hear your anger, Ralph, but it is not justified. You do not believe that now, but perhaps you may. For the time being, we must set your questions and our answers, such answers as we may give, aside." "Why?" "Because the time of severing has come for this man. Watch closely that you may learn and know." Clotho stepped to the left side of the bed. Lachesis approached from the right, walking through Fay Chapin as he went. Fay bent over, afflicted with a sudden coughing fit, and then opened his book of chess problems again as it eased. Ralph, I can't watch this. I can't watch them do it. But Ralph thought she would. He thought they both would. He held her tighter as Clotho and Lachesis bent over Jimmy V. Their faces were lit with love and caring and gentleness. They made Ralph think of the faces he had once seen in a Rembrandt painting. The Night Watch, he thought it had been called. Their auras mingled and overlapped above Jimmy's chest. And suddenly the man in the bed opened his eyes. He looked through the two little bald doctors at the ceiling for a moment, his expression vague and puzzled, and then his gaze shifted toward the door and he smiled.
"Hey, look who's here!"
Jimmy V exclaimed. His voice was rusty and choked, but Ralph could still hear his South Boston wise guy accent. Where "here" came out "here." Faye jumped. The book of chess problems tumbled out of his lap and fell to the floor. He leaned over and took Jimmy's hand, but Jimmy ignored him and kept looking across the room at Ralph and Lois.
"It's Ralph Roberts and Paul Chass's wife with him. Say, Ralphie, do you remember the day we tried to get into that tenth revival so we could hear him sing Amazing Grace?"
"I remember, Jimmy." Jimmy appeared to smile, and then his eyes slipped closed again. Lachesis placed his hands against the dying man's cheeks and moved his head a bit, like a barber getting ready to shave a customer. At the same moment, Clotho leaned even closer, opened his scissors, and slid them forward so that the long blades held Jimmy V's black balloon string. As Clotho closed the scissors, Lachesis leaned forward and kissed Jimmy's forehead. "Go in peace, friend." There was a small, unimportant snick sound. The segment of the balloon string above the scissors drifted up toward the ceiling and disappeared. The death bag in which Jimmy V lay turned a momentary bright white, then winked out of existence, just as Rosalie's had done earlier that evening. Jimmy opened his eyes again and looked at Faye. He started to smile, Ralph thought, and then his gaze turned fixed and distant. The dimples which had begun to form at the corners of his mouth smoothed out. "Jimmy?" Faye shook Jimmy V's shoulder, running his hand through Lachesis's side to do it. "You all right, Jimmy?" "Oh, shit." Faye got up and left the room, not quite running. "Clotho, do you see and understand that what we do with love and respect? That we are, in fact, the physicians of last resort? It is vital to our dealings with you, Ralph and Lois, that you understand that." "Yes."
"Yes."
Ralph hadn't intended to agree with anything either of them said, but that phrase, "the physicians of last resort," sliced cleanly and effortlessly through his anger. It felt true. They had freed Jimmy V from a world where there was nothing left for him but pain. Yes, they had undoubtedly stood in room 317 with Ralph on a sleety afternoon some 7 months ago and given Carolyn the same release. And yes, they went about their work with love and respect. Any doubts he might have had on that score had been laid to rest when Lachesis kissed Jimmy V's forehead. But did love and respect give them the right to put him, and Lois too, through hell, and then send them after a supernatural being that had gone off the rails? Did it give them the right to even dream that two ordinary people, neither of them young anymore, could deal with such a creature? Lachesis, "Let us move on from this place. It's going to fill up with people, and we need to talk." "Do we have any choice?"
Their answers,
"Yes, of course. There is always a choice," came back quickly, colored with overtones of surprise. Clotho and Lachesis walked toward the door. Ralph and Lois shrank back to let them pass. The auras of the little bald doctors swept over them for a moment, however, and Ralph registered them in taste and texture. The taste of sweet apples, the texture of dry, light bark. As they left side by side, speaking gravely and respectfully to each other, Faye came back in, now accompanied by a pair of nurses. These newcomers passed through Lachesis and Clotho, then through Ralph and Lois, without slowing or seeming to notice anything untoward. In the hall outside, Life went on at its usual muted pace. No buzzers went off, no lights flashed, no orderlies came sprinting down the hallway, pushing the crash wagon ahead of them. No one cried "Stat!" over the loudspeaker. Death was too common a visitor here for such things. Ralph guessed that it was not welcome, even under such circumstances as these, but it was familiar and accepted. He also guessed that Jimmy V would have been happy enough with his exit from the third floor of Derry Home. He had done it with no fuss or bother, and he hadn't had to show anyone either his driver's license or his Blue Cross major medical card. He had died with the dignity that simple, expected things often hold. One or two moments of consciousness, accompanied by a slightly wider perception of what was going on around him. And then, poof, pack up all my care and woe, Blackbird. Bye-bye. They joined the bald docks in the hallway outside Bob Polhurst's room. Through the open door, they could see the death watch continuing around the old teacher's bed. Lois, the man closest to the bed is Bill McGovern, a friend of ours. There's something wrong with him, something awful. If we do what you want, could you? But Lachesis and Clotho were shaking their heads in unison. Clotho, nothing can be changed. Yes, Ralph thought. Dorrance knew. Done bun can't be undone. Lois, when will it happen? Clotho, your friend belongs to the other, to the third, to the one Ralph has already named Atropos. But Atropos could tell you the exact hour of the man's death no more than we could. He cannot even tell whom he will take next. Atropos is an agent of the random. This phrase sent a chill through Ralph's heart. Lachesis, but this is no place for us to talk. Come. Lachesis took one of Clotho's hands, then held out his free hand to Ralph. At the same time, Clotho reached toward Lois. She hesitated, then looked at Ralph. Ralph, in his turn, looked grimly at Lachesis. You better not hurt her. Neither of you will be hurt, Ralph. Take my hand. I'm a stranger in paradise, Ralph's mind finished. Then he sighed through his teeth, nodded to Lois, and gripped Lachesis' outstretched hand. That shock of recognition, as deep and pleasant as an unexpected encounter with an old and valued friend, washed over him again. Apples and bark. Memories of orchards he had walked through as a kid. He was somehow aware, without actually seeing it, that his aura had changed color and become, at least for a little while, the gold-flecked green of Clotho and Lachesis. Lois took Clotho's hand, inhaled a sharp little gasp over her teeth, then smiled hesitantly. Clotho, complete the circle, Ralph and Lois. Don't be afraid. All is well. Boy, do I ever disagree with that, Ralph thought. But when Lois reached for his hand, he grasped her fingers. The taste of apples and the texture of dry bark was joined by some dark and unknowable spice. Ralph inhaled its aroma deeply and then smiled at Lois. She smiled back, no hesitation in that smile, and Ralph felt a dim, far-off confusion. How could you be afraid? How could you even hesitate when what they brought felt this good and seemed this right? I sympathize, Ralph, but hesitate anyway, a voice counseled. Ralph? Ralph! She sounded alarmed and giddy at the same time. Ralph looked around just in time to see the top of the door of room 315 descending past her shoulders. Except it wasn't the door going down. It was Lois going up. All of them going up, still holding hands in a circle. Ralph had just gotten this through his head when momentary darkness, sharp as a knife edge, crossed his vision like a shadow thrown by the slat of a Venetian blind. He had a brief glimpse of narrow pipes that were probably part of the hospital's sprinkler system, surrounded by tufted pink pads of insulation. Then he was looking down a long, tiled corridor. A gurney cart was rolling straight at his head, which he suddenly realized had surfaced like a periscope in one of the fourth-floor corridors. He heard Lois cry out and felt her grip on his hand tighten. Ralph closed his eyes instinctively and waited for the approaching gurney to flatten his skull.
Clotho. Be calm. Please be calm. Remember that these things exist on a different level of reality from the one where you are now.
Ralph opened his eyes. The gurney was gone, although he could hear its receding wheels. The sound was coming from behind him now. The gurney, like McGovern's friend, had passed right through him. The four of them were now levitating slowly into the corridor of what had to be the pediatrics wing. Fairy tale creatures pranced and gambolled up and down the walls, and characters from Disney's Aladdin and the Little Mermaid were decaled onto the windows of a large, brightly lighted play area. A doctor and a nurse strolled toward them, discussing a case.
Further tests seem indicated, but only if we can make at least 90% sure that...
The doctor walked through Ralph, and as he did, Ralph understood that he had started smoking again on the sly after 5 years off the weed and was feeling guilty as hell about it. Then they were gone. Ralph looked down just in time to see his feet emerge from the tiled floor. He turned to Lois, smiling tentatively.
It sure beats the elevator, doesn't it?
She nodded. Her grip on his hand was still very tight. They rose through the fifth floor, surfaced in a doctor's lounge on the sixth. Two doctors, the full-sized kind, present, one watching an old F-Troop rerun and the other snoring on the hideous Swedish modern sofa. And then they were on the roof. The night was clear, moonless, gorgeous. Stars glittered across the arc of the sky in an extravagant, misty sprawl of light. The wind was blowing hard, and he thought of Mrs. Perrine saying Indian summer was over. He could mark her words. Ralph could hear the wind, but not feel it, although he had an idea he could feel it if he wanted to. It was just a matter of concentrating in the right way. Even as this thought came, he sensed some minor momentary change in his body, something that felt like a blink. Suddenly his hair was blowing back from his forehead, and he could hear his pants cuffs flapping around his shins. He shivered. Mrs. Perrine's back had been right about the weather changing. Ralph gave another interior blink, and the push of the wind was gone. He looked over at Lachesis.
Can I let go of your hand now?
Lachesis nodded and dropped his own grip. Clotho released Lois's hand. Ralph looked across town to the west and saw the pulsing blue runway lights of the airport. Beyond them was the gridwork of orange arc sodiums that marked Cape Green, one of the new housing developments on the far side of the Barrens. And someplace, in the sprinkle of lights just east of the airport, was Harris Avenue.
It's beautiful, isn't it, Ralph?
He nodded and thought that standing there and seeing the city spread out in the dark like this was worth everything he had been through since the insomnia had started. Everything and then some. But that wasn't a thought he entirely trusted. He turned to Lachesis and Clotho.
All right. Explain. Who are you? Who is he? And what do you want us to do?
The two bald docs were standing between two rapidly turning heat ventilators, which were spraying brownish-purple fans of effluent into the air. They glanced nervously at each other, and Lachesis gave Clotho an almost imperceptible nod. Clotho stepped forward, looked from Ralph to Lois, and seemed to gather his thoughts.
Very well. First you must understand that the things which are happening, while unexpected and distressing, are not precisely unnatural. My colleague and I do what we were made to do. Atropos does what he was made to do. And you, my short-time friends, will do what you were made to do.
Ralph favored him with a bright, bitter smile. There goes freedom of choice, I guess.
Lachesis. You mustn't think so. It's simply that what you call freedom of choice is part of what we call Ka, the great wheel of being.
Lois, we see as through a glass darkly. Is that what you mean? Clotho, smiling his somehow youthful smile.
The Bible, I believe, and a very good way of putting it.
Ralph, also pretty convenient for guys like you, but let's pass on that for now. We have a saying that isn't from the Bible, gentlemen, but it's a pretty good one just the same. Don't gild the lily. I hope you'll keep it in mind. Ralph had an idea, however, that that might be a little too much to ask.